Hey folks, Sam Jones here, and we're back in the pristine audio recording studios of Off Camera. For any of you who tuned in last week to the Bo Burnham episode, you also heard me introduce the show from a remote location, and we had a little fun with it. We decided to have a contest to see who could guess by the sounds and descriptions where I was in the world. And if you recall, there were roosters crowing, palm trees swaying, I was by a bay where it rains twice a day. Well, I got a lot of responses, and apparently there are places all over the world where chickens live in tropical climates, and I was impressed by how many exotic places you all think I was visiting, including someone who thought I was on an island off the coast of Ireland, which, that would be interesting. But we had a winner. His name is Sam Sauerhaft, and he guessed correctly that I was in Hanalei Bay on the island of Kauai. So, Sam, we're going to send you a care package out. And look for that in the mail. And to everyone else, thanks for playing, thanks for writing in, and now on with the show. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Carey Mulligan. When Carey Mulligan first stepped foot on set of 2005's Pride and Prejudice, she was convinced she had won the lottery. It was her first professional job and her first time acting in front of a camera. But there she was, alongside Judi Dench, Keira Knightley, Brenda Blethyn, and Jenna Malone. As she describes it, the entire experience was like summer camp. It didn't feel like work at all. Well, Carey was living her dream, but she was still convinced it was all a fluke. She remembers thinking, after this, I'll reapply to drama school and maybe I'll get in this time. Her first lead role came in 2009 with the coming-of-age film An Education. Her compelling performance led to an Academy Award nomination and widespread critical acclaim, even though Carey was originally devastated when she watched herself on screen. She says, it was like listening to your voice on the answering machine and wincing because of how awful you sound. But multiply that by 500. Carey was convinced her first shot would be her last, worrying, Sundance is going to be a disaster. They're going to send me home. Of course, as we all know, the opposite happened. Since then, she's amassed a stunning body of work, on screen and on stage. Films like Shame, Far From the Madding Crowd, Mudbound, Inside Llewyn Davis, and plays like Girls and Boys and The Seagull, and many more. In her newest performance, Paul Dano's directorial debut, Wildlife, she plays a messy, complicated woman struggling to find her identity underneath the crippling expectations that come with her role as a wife and mother in the 1960s. Somewhat surprisingly, her character has generated controversy among those used to more idealistic portrayals of women. She says, it's amazing that we still live in a world where a real, messy, complex woman expressing herself in a multitude of ways is dismissed as unrealistic because she's not what we want to see. Carey joins Off Camera to talk about battling stage fright, learning how to put her insecurities in perspective, and why sometimes the key to unlocking a character is to take off your shoes. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Carey.
Hi, Sam.
You know, before we start talking about Wildlife and all the other fascinating things you've been doing, I owe you a big thank you. Because a few years back, I made a film with your husband, Marcus. Mm. And it was a documentary, and there were a lot of producer cooks in the kitchen. Mm. And so there was quite a bit of back and forth with cuts and edits. And I remember sending him the film and him being on the phone with it saying, oh my God, watching myself at first was such a horrible experience. But then Carey saw it and she said I came off good in it and I relaxed. And I thought, I don't even know this woman, but she totally did me a solid favor.
You're welcome.
From the other side of the world, you know?
It was great.
Thank you for saying that.
It really was.
But it made me think of this thing that must happen to everybody the first time they see themselves as a lead in a film, where you're how you are in your head, and then you see how you are on a screen. Mm. And it made me wonder about the sort of your first experience with that on a leading film, which I assume would be An Education.
Yeah.
What was sort of your initial reaction to watching yourself?
Yeah, really, really bored. I thought I didn't do anything.
Bored.
Yeah. I remember calling my mum and they brought me out to LA like a week before Sundance to, I think to like meet, to get a publicist. And they showed me the film, and I watched it on my own in a screening room. And I called my mum afterwards, and I was, I think, almost in tears. And I was saying, "Mum, it's so boring. Like, I don't do anything with my face. I just, it's just like my face, and it's so big, and I don't, I'm just not interesting. Like, nothing's happening. I'm not, you know, I'm just, it just looks sort of wooden and awful." And I was like, "It's going to be a disaster. Sundance is going to be a disaster. Like, they're going to send me home. It's awful."
And I was, no need to get a publicist.
I know, and I do great press myself. I was terrified. Like, I was like, "It's all over." Like, that was, you know, and it's, this is going to be like really embarrassing.
Really?
Yeah. It was like listening to your voice on an answering machine, you know, and that, like, the way that it makes you wince, like how ridiculous and awful you sound, but times 500. And I was just, yeah, I thought it was all done there. That job was so interesting because it was the first time I played a lead in the film, but I started acting when I was 18. I played only supporting roles, and no one was watching me. And when I was in plays, like, you know, the first play I did, you know, was at the Royal Court Theatre, and I played the kid in it, and, like, no one was watching me. They were watching, like, Anastasia Hilly and the other actors who were on stage who were really well-known. So I'd done all these jobs where I was, like, background supporting, and then we were doing this film, and it sort of just felt like that, like, oh, well, this is a tiny film, and this will play at the Curzon Soho for a week. Like, no one's going to see this, so, like, I'll just keep kind of... I didn't feel, like, the pressure of, like, a leading role. So I didn't really prep or, like, have any kind of way into it. I just did it and then saw it and thought it was so dull. I was so dull, not the film, but I was so dull to watch. And I'd never really thought about, I didn't have a way of working really until I did that film. I just sort of, I was just winging it.
So you didn't get pressure from any powers that be going into that film of, oh, now you're the lead and...
No, it was the weirdest thing because the film went from like, I mean, that film was around for like 2 years probably, or maybe even longer before it actually happened, maybe even longer. I was like, oh, it'll be like Pride and Prejudice, which was my first ever job, which
right.
felt like a film. And I knew that it would be in cinemas, but this felt like so indie that I was like, this could go straight to DVD. You know, I just hadn't, you know, so there was no pressure associated with it because it was like, this is tiny and no one will see it. And
must have been a blessing in disguise too.
Yeah, it was
great. To walk in like that. Because in Pride and Prejudice, did you feel like unseen?
Yeah.
Like you could just sort of do
your
thing?
In the best way, it was great. I mean, I literally, it was my first ever professional job and thank God for Jenna Malone, who played my sister.
Right.
So she was Lydia, I was Kitty, and they're kind of like twins until Lydia leaves sort of midway through the story, and I just copied everything she did. Like...
Really?
Copied her. Yeah. Because I didn't know what I was doing. I was on a film set, and it was like Judi Dench was over there. I was
right.
completely...
And yet you weren't like there for a lark. This is what you wanted to do.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, this had been everything I had dreamt about doing, but it just came to it that when I got there, I didn't know what to do, because... And I'd never ever done anything in front of a camera. The first time I got in front of a camera was my audition for Pride and Prejudice. So this was the first time I was doing any kind of acting on screen. Then also the first part I ever got was Kitty, who's a completely, you know, who's just this sort of out of control, giggling mess of a teenager. So it was so big and everything had to be so kind of, she was so loud and messy and that was... You know, that was so not me at all. And so I was just like, well, she knows what she's doing. She's a proper actress. I'll just do everything she does and just copy Jenna.
So what's the process of copying? Like,
literally, we developed this laugh because they're always laughing, the girls.
Right.
And so we developed in, we had a great, that was like one of the only times in my entire career where we had like real rehearsal. Like we had weeks of rehearsal. We had a whole week that was just dancing. And then we had... you know, rehearsals as a family. We had a whole day where we went to the Bennett house and it was totally empty and we played games in there all day, like sardines and hide and seek. You know, so we really like properly kind of bonded. And then we came up with this laugh that they did where we wanted all the sisters to kind of have the same laugh. So I can't remember who came up with it, but basically we all kind of, you'd kind of hyperventilate. So stupid, but we'd all go. And then by doing that, somehow that always just made us hysterical. And so that would be our laugh. So Jenna and I, before every take, would be standing like, you know, usually we were running in and out of rooms. Like that was our role in the, my role, certainly she had a much more of a role in the film, but my role was essentially to run in and laugh or run in tears or something. So we would stand like behind the door going, Like something about both doing it would just make us completely hysterical.
No, it works. I'm testament to the fact it works.
Yeah, so that was the whole job, was just me being like, and it was just so great. It was like summer camp. That wasn't a job. That was like, I'd won some sort of prize in a, you know, television show to get to be on a film set.
Did Jenna catch on that you were copying her? Was she okay with the whole deal?
She fully took me under her wing.
Like, she did?
Yeah, completely. She totally knew that I had no idea what I was doing, and she was like, I've got you.
And maybe you just have this quality where people
want to take care of me. No, yeah, I mean, I was a complete fish out of water, and they were amazing.
I imagine that it wasn't lost on you that you're surrounded by like the greatest actors, you know, Brenda Blethyn and Judi Dench. And were you looking for, I don't know, moments to ask advice, or is it just like, I'm just going to absorb it all?
I mean, I honestly thought the whole thing was such a fluke that I was still, when I was shooting that, thinking like, well, after this, I'll reapply to drama school or something. You know, I didn't think like that would lead to anything else. So it wasn't like, I wasn't on there being like, well, now this is my career started.
See, now that's pretty funny, that this is a big film.
Yeah.
Big cast, and you're like, well, I'll have to go back to drama school.
Well, it was like, you know, it was a ridiculous first job. It just didn't feel, it all felt very surreal. So I don't think I've ever asked anyone for advice.
When someone's starting out at anything and something happens like that, like you're in this film and then scripts start to be sent, what is the message you were sort of telling yourself as to why this was happening?
I think that was part of the problem of that whole year for me, was like, you know, because then it kind of went into award season and all that kind of stuff. And I think I genuinely felt like, I don't quite know why anyone is letting me into these parties.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit. I took it way too seriously, like way too seriously, looking back. But I was a bit like, Meryl Streep's over there, like, I just shouldn't be here, this is sort of awful. So I think that was part of the problem of that year, was like, I was analysing why people were reacting like that.
Did you feel like you'd tricked people? Like,
yeah, basically, yeah. I felt like, oh, I was like, you think that's good? All right. I don't know, it just felt weird. But like, I also think sometimes like people just really want to get behind a thing, and like, you know, maybe sometimes someone just calls it and then everyone falls in line. Like, I do think a lot of the stuff with Oscar stuff and award season is like, you become sort of, particularly, you know, I think they love every so often to just find like a girl and like make a massive deal out of her. And it doesn't necessarily correlate to that performance or whatever. It can just be like a moment in time where, you know, or you wear the right outfit to a big party, and then people think like they can dress you, and then that becomes part of it. Like, I think there's so many things that feed into that, that are about campaigning, and like, you know, if it comes down to that, then I shook a lot of hands and I held a lot of babies, you know, and I think that is all part of it. And to try and view it as a meritocracy is just naive. So I think I probably was questioning what the fuck I was doing there.
Gosh, I wonder if there's a way to put words to that experience of something you dreamed about happening your whole life, and then it happens like that. And
well, that also happened with Judi Dench on Pride and Prejudice, because I had an actual vivid dream about working with Judi Dench.
Is that true?
Yeah, when I was like 15, and then my first ever job, the first day of rehearsals, Judi Dench walked up to me and introduced herself to me and said, I believe we have the same agent, which we do. And I was like,
you were like, gosh, either I have a pretty good agent or you should get a new agent, because this is my first job.
Yeah, what the hell. But that was like, I almost couldn't process that. It was just ridiculous.
Well, we should talk about Wildlife, because it's one of these films, I think, that it's really subtle and it's really good. Paul Dano directed it, first time director, wrote it with his wife, Zoe Kazan. And it's you and Jake Gyllenhaal, and you play a couple that has an only child, named Ed Oxenbold, right? And through the course of the film, your marriage falls apart. And I just wondered if seeing this script, if it stuck out to you as not a part for a woman that you get to see that often. And if that was the reason to jump on it.
Yeah, that was the second reason. The first reason was Paul directing it. So Paul calling me and saying, I'm going to send you a script that I'm going to direct. And I was like, in my mind, I was like, I'm doing it. But then I also I do have that tendency to like jump on things, and so if I have a gut instinct about something, I'll be like, I'm in, and then sometimes I get in trouble because maybe a couple of days later I'm like, oh, maybe I'm not in, which is a problem, which I'm working on. But with Paul, I was in my mind, I was like, I'm in, but then I stopped myself from saying it because I was like, but wait to see what the part is. And then he emailed it, and I read it, and I was so happy that it was that good a part. And then it was like a complete no-brainer. I called him about like 90 minutes later.
What struck you about it?
Well, I think that she didn't have like a clear journey arc. Like there was no like beginning, middle and end to her. You know, there's something kind of messy about her story where there's not a traditional kind of cinematic journey. And in between that is a whole lot of kind of misguided decisions. And she's doing her very best to, I think, do the right thing. But it's just messy and pretty volatile and out of control, and really is like probably what you would see if you put a camera on any of the worst week of any of our lives.
Like, sure, right.
You know, and I think that was, I was so intrigued by that. And not coming to a place of like resolution felt really truthful.
I read a thing that happened recently where there was some Q&A
our friend in New York.
Yes. But I think, thank God for that, because I feel like you were able to speak to this entire subject based upon sort of being baited by someone who didn't get the film or didn't understand. But basically the story was that he used the Q&A to criticize the performance and that this character was unsympathetic. And you were able to sort of, in your answer, brilliantly say, yes, I don't think that we're used to seeing women on screen that are allowed to be messy and unsympathetic and are allowed to make choices that aren't for the good of their family and aren't for the good of the bigger picture. And it sort of laid bare the architecture of kind of how women are depicted in films most of the time. And it sort of got me thinking about if when reading this there was a subversive part of your brain that sort of almost expected some reaction like that, or if...
Yeah, I didn't expect it to be this strong.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly having done like 10 Q&As in the last 2 weeks, that sentiment hasn't been expressed in quite the same way, but we've definitely had it numerous times. I haven't had I mean, he ripped into me, that guy, and into the performance, and he was like, and that kid is just so namby-pamby and just takes everything and he doesn't say anything. I mean, it's just so unrealistic. And I was like, have you met a 14-year-old? They're not like...
They don't speak to their parents at all.
No, exactly. Like, all right, but yeah, he was horrified by Jeanette. And it does, it just speaks to what we expect and what we've come to expect from women that we see on screen. And that's just what's modeled for us from, you know, from day one of what we see. And I think, you know, if you think about it, there is just... And I've certainly been offered these roles. It's the sort of dutiful, earnest, supportive wife who agrees with everything and like the wife to the great man is the, you know, and that they are usually long suffering, but they don't act out. They fall in line, and that's what we've come to expect now. Is that women are either absolute saints or they're like crack addicts who ruin your whole life. You know, we see that as well. We see like the very, very, very worst, but we just don't see anything in between, really. So that was certainly a draw to doing it, but I didn't think that the reaction would be this strong to the unlikable woman.
You start to wonder what storytelling's role in our society is and the role it's played in sort of teaching women how to behave or something like that.
Well, yeah, and she's modeling that. She's trying to copy what she's seen for 14 years. I think she's an impeccable mother and an impeccable wife, and she is being the all-round best American wife until this week, you know.
Right.
So she's under that pressure as well of, you know, and that's what you see at the beginning of the film. She's wearing the apron, she's making the dinner perfectly, she's supporting him when he loses his job. It's just when he reneges on his side of the deal and the injustice that he can just fuck off and go and fight a wildfire and she can't, you know. Like, why can he go off and have his, you know, search for identity, and I'm stuck here, I can't go anywhere.
When I started thinking about it, I realized that most films that you've done are comments, either intentionally or unintentionally, about how women are treated in the world. And it makes me wonder if throughout your career and all the things that you've been offered, all the parts that we haven't seen that you've turned down, and if the architecture of that kind of storytelling, that viewpoint, has sort of been laid bare a little bit to you.
Yeah, I mean, I've never had a plan for how to do this except to play people that I believe are real people. But obviously, in retrospect, I can see a through line between all of them, particularly Far From the Madding Crowd, Suffragette, Wildlife, that these are women who are out of their time. But I think that's, you know, I remember we were talking about this when Far From the Madding Crowd came out, but when that book came out, it was panned by the critics because she was, because they said she was, it was a totally unrealistic portrayal of a woman.
Same as Wildlife.
That's not how women behave. They wouldn't behave like that. They wouldn't be so, you know, outrageous. It's just not realistic. And people ripped it to shreds. And then it, you know, became a classic.
But doesn't that piss you off?
I can't get mad at Victorian men. you know, that's just... But it's kind of amazing that we are still in that world where you
right.
see a real woman expressing herself in a, you know, in a multitude of ways, and it's dismissed as being unrealistic because we just don't want to see that.
Well, that's the irony of that guy's comment, probably, is that the reason it affected him so strongly is because it was portrayed in a realistic way enough to get his hackles up.
Yeah, and it bothered him. And we had a really, really... We had a guy the other night who asked us, he was like, what's the deal with all the sexual tension between her and her son?
What? you're like, that's about you.
Fully, fully. But, right, isn't that interesting? But I just, that wasn't, the way that he framed the question wasn't the question to answer, so I kind of shut it down. But then we did have a conversation about it with, you know, I talked about it with a psychologist who reframed the question, and you know, it is interesting, but I think what Jeanette's trying to do is, you know, this is all about reinvention. This is about, like, I've been a mother and a wife for so long, I can't remember who I am. Like, I can't remember if I had a personality outside of being these two things to these two men. Like, I'm now just mum and just wife. And, like, I was someone when I was 19, now I can't remember who it is. But then, you know, so part of what she's doing, I think, is trying to completely destroy that image that she had, which feels to her like a lie. Like, I'm not that woman. I'm not that perfect woman. I'm not, you know, everything you thought I was, I'm not. So erase all that, forget who that was, and we'll start again. So, you know, part of what she, the way that she talks to him, the sort of harshness to her tone or the way that she's so blunt or dismissive is like trying to eradicate the former version of herself so she can start again and be
right.
someone new, someone more honest, but it's just misguided because he's 14 and he doesn't know how to process it. But that's where the lack of boundaries come from. So we did have that conversation, but the way he framed it was just creepy. So that had to be shut down.
Yes.
He also was like, well, they spent a lot of time in the bathroom. We're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
That's what you just say, security.
Almost, yeah.
I wonder, after you, you know, immediately said yes, what was the scary part of the process of wrapping your head around this for you?
Yeah, I think the complexity of that, of her struggle, of whatever she's going through in that week, it was kind of figuring that out. So I needed to have a few ideas of what it was that she was going through. And that was actually made much easier by just doing it. Like, once we were there, we were dealing with the costumes, we were, you know, that I could map it out better. But when you're playing someone who's out of control, so to speak, which she seems to be for a portion of this film, you actually need to be completely in control. Otherwise, it's just messy.
You have to make certain decisions.
You have to make lots and lots of very small, concrete decisions that make the thing make sense. Because otherwise, it's just like, it's not fun to see someone like just constantly crying or you know, being, you have to have like an idea, you have to plan of how you're going to get through it. Otherwise, it's just sort of messy. And
when you read a script, are you looking for lines or certain clues that'll turn into like keys for you?
Not initially. I think there are some lines that become more important as I went on, but not going into it. I mean, I'm looking for like a rich and interesting and dialogue, because so often women have nothing to say in films. It's amazing how, if you actually count up how many lines you have in a film, sometimes as a woman, it's like But I'm not looking at that. Those things don't really key in until I'm on set, like, and then they become more and more meaningful. And then they sometimes become like part of the fabric of the character, but they're not things that I kind of pick out initially.
In thinking about you sitting down with this script and sort of trying to work out how you're going to tackle it and everything, what is the hardest thing about your job that you continually kind of bump up against?
Just good old insecurity. Like,
really?
Just believing, not feeling confident about anything I'm doing for, like, the first 3 days of filming, maybe.
When does that fear manifest itself? Does it ever manifest itself in the prep of, like, this is coming, or it's...
Not really. It's, like, it's day one. I, you know, get on set, and I'm suddenly paralyzed by fear and think, like, this is all wrong. So I don't feel it massively. I mean, I'm just excited in the prep. I'm, you know... And prep has changed as well. Like, prep when I was 23 is totally different to prep now. Like,
yeah, tell me how that's different.
I have two children.
Oh, true.
And, you know, so I did a monologue this year that was like 90 minutes on stage alone.
And right, Girls and Boys.
Girls and Boys. And I walked into day one of rehearsal and I didn't know a single line and I hadn't given it any thought. Because I had a 5-month-old and a 2-year-old. So I just showed up at work and like we did it. And somehow, you know, I crammed the words in so that by the time I did the first preview, I knew the play. But I didn't spend like 6 months before that. And I'd been attached to it for 6 months before. But I didn't do a jot of work on it because I had two children to look after and I just couldn't. So, you know, prep is different now. And I think that there's something kind of freeing about that, you know, I think I used to go into every job feeling so unbelievably unqualified to be there that I would spend months, you know, literally on Gatsby, I did months of reading. And Geneva King, I read every letter that she was ever sent or written. And, you know, I read like 6 books about Zelda Fitzgerald and I, you know, went to Princeton and looked at the archives. I mean, I did everything.
Really? So pre-child Carrie was obsessive.
I mean, it varied still within that, depending on like how quickly I came onto the job or whatever. But yeah, I would do everything I could pre-kids. And then...
And did it help?
I mean, it made me feel like I'd done my homework and that gave me confidence. And for me, it's always about like, do I have enough confidence to be there? But I don't know. Probably not. But then I did... First job I did after I had Evie was Mudbound. And... I didn't get to do a whole lot for that and just kind of like got there and was like, amazing actors, amazing director, great script, like, just give it a go, you know?
Well,
so
you
it's just different now. And I'm sure as they get older, I'll find a structure again to be able to like take my time to, you know, go off and do stuff. But, you know, as it is, like, I don't want to be away unless I absolutely have to. And,
right.
And that is like filming.
But it brings up a question of, and maybe this ties into having kids and not having enough time to prep, but I wonder if there's, if you're always sort of also searching for how to get back to the actress you were before you knew so much.
Mm.
Do you ever think about that? Like,
yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, there's things I've learned that now I can't do without. So there are things that like, even without sort of months and months of prep on Wildlife, I knew going into that film that I would need like a soundtrack for her life and I'd need like a couple of things that were important in the book and then I'd need a couple of things from a poem or something to hook into. Like, I think the very least I need to do is create enough backstory that I can invent things as I go along. So like in the scene where Jerry is leaving for the wildfire, it opens on silence from both of us. And we're kind of midway through, like probably a 4-hour argument. You
right.
know? And it's, you know, it's got to the point in the argument where you've screamed, 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 you've both cried, and now you're quiet again and no one's talking. And it's like a standoff. And then our son comes home. And in that moment, you know, I'm inventing things about our wedding or when I'm, you know, so those things. But what I used to do before, when I was back in my single non-family days, was do all of that before I got there and like have it all kind of mapped out in my head. Now I'm just sort of like, you know, I'll listen to a song on my iPhone before that take starts. And then as that take starts, I'll be hearing that song, thinking about this thing, and then the scene starts. So it's like, it's much more off the sort of off the, how do you say it?
You can generate a memory quicker and make it real to you.
And it feels more real having not thought about it too much. There's a basic amount of stuff that I need to be able to like have it in the scene so that it always feels like there's something else going on apart from just, you know, that the, there's a sort of inner life going on.
Right. Now, Paul being a first-time director on this, but being an actor, it made me curious if you'd ever been directed by an actor before and if it was a different experience to have someone who really understands that process.
I don't think, no, I haven't been ever directed by an actor before. But yeah, I mean, he had that extra thing where he could see, like, you know, every time I was holding back because I was a little bit afraid to do too much, or, you know, I was not really kind of standing behind my choices, he would know when to step in and, like, encourage me. Or
he could see that.
He could see it. And he could see, like, yeah, I remember the scene where Jake leaves with the wildfire. And then we got to shooting it, we kind of got stuck in a rut and we both were getting kind of frustrated. And before we got to the point where that kind of implodes and becomes kind of a problem, Paul, like, stopped us and we did some weird, like, acting exercise thing that I've never done before in my whole life, and then took 5 minutes to do that and then went back, and then the scene was great again. So, like, he was really so good at noticing, probably because he's experienced all of it himself, but, like, he was great at noticing those things and, like, and just changing it up so that we could keep going.
Were there any fear that first time director that it was going to be difficult?
No, not with Paul. I kind of thought, like, you know, he's so cool, Paul. And I was like, well, 28-day film, you know, period film, like, it's really stressful. Like, maybe I'll see him, like, ruffled. And I never saw it. He was just always, like, completely chilled out.
You just needed the secret camera in his hotel room.
I know. And I'm sure if I'd seen, you know, and I know now, obviously, after we've shot it, that it was, like, obviously really stressful and things were changing all the time, and the stuff that happens on indie filmmaking where you, like, lose a location and or you wanted 30 extras and you can have 7 and all that stuff was happening, like, every day, but he just never let it kind of come into the set.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. I want to talk a little bit about this week's sponsor, Quip. You know, it's that time of year again where we all like to do a little gift giving and hopefully a little gift receiving of things we actually enjoy and use. And there's a gift that I want to suggest this year that I can say with confidence that people will love, because I use it every day, and so does my whole family. And it's something they'll not only use once a day, they'll use it twice a day, we hope. And it was featured on Oprah's O-List, and it's perfect for everyone with a mouth. And the gift is Quip, an electric toothbrush designed to make brushing better. You know, when you think of the perfect gift, you probably don't think of an electric toothbrush. But it's actually a perfect gift to give, and here's why. It's a toothbrush you can love. It's sleek, it's lightweight, it does everything that a plug-in electric toothbrush does, but it does it better without plugging in. And quite simply, it's just a better toothbrush. It has sensitive sonic vibrations that are gentle on your sensitive gums. And it has a built-in timer with guiding pulses to remind you when to switch sides. And if you're traveling over the holidays, Quip is the perfect travel toothbrush. It has a multi-use cover that mounts to mirrors and unmounts to slide over the bristles for on-the-go brushing. And it doesn't require any chargers, and it runs for 3 months on one charge. And best of all, Quip is the gift that keeps refreshing, with brush heads automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. And you can even gift prepaid refills for a year to make sure they're never using old, worn-out, or ineffective bristles. Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association and has thousands of verified 5-star reviews. So that's why I love Quip, and that's why I think it's a great gift, and it's a great time to try it out. Heck, get one for yourself and get one for your mother or your teacher or that guy at work that always has a pastrami and onion sandwich. That would be a great guy to give Quip to. They have over 5,000 verified 5-star reviews. And Quip looks like a big-ticket tech gift, but it has a stocking stuffer price, starting at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you'll get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/offcamera. That's getquip.com/offcamera. So happy holidays, happy shopping, and happy brushing. Now back to the show.
I read that your first love was not going to the movies every weekend and wanted to be on the screen, but it was theater.
Mm-hmm.
You land on Broadway in The Seagull playing Nina.
Mm.
And I wondered, like, in the same way that I wondered about an education and Pride and Prejudice, I wonder if having a dream like that and being so excited about that kind of life and then landing there, if it was overwhelming. And if you could just tell me a little bit about that experience.
I'd done it in London, and I'm certainly starting in London. It was a really huge, scary thing. But equally in that, like, I wasn't well known. Kristen Scott Thomas was playing Alcardon, and Chiwetel Ejiofor was playing Trigorin, and Mackenzie Crook was playing Constantine. So I was the nobody. So again, like, I didn't feel like, I know it was like a great part, but Alcardon was Kristen. So I just felt like, oh, well, everyone's watching. It doesn't really matter what I'm like. And London went well. I felt like I was living and breathing that part by the time we got to New York. I remember there's a line in the play where she, in Act Two, she has this very long conversation with Trigorin. She doesn't really say anything. And Trigorin's just like waxing lyrical on writing. And she's just completely head over heels in love with him. And he walks off the stage at the end and she's on her own. And she sort of looks out over the lake, i.e. the audience, and says, "I'm dreaming." And 9 times out of 10 in London, I found that kind of excruciating. Like, I just couldn't. I remember walking out of a rehearsal once because I started crying because I couldn't do it because I just felt so exposed, like not talking to the audience, but being completely alone and I always really struggled with it in London. And then I remember the first night in New York, I was on my own and I looked out at this theatre, which was the Walter Kerr Theatre, which is where I had seen Kevin Bacon do a play there when I was 14, and I come on a trip with my mum to New York. And I was on my own in that theatre in front of like 900 people. And I said, "I'm dreaming." And it was I couldn't believe it. I couldn't fathom that I was there doing that part on that stage less than 10 years after I'd watched a play there and sort of dreamt about being on Broadway. So I said, and every night in Broadway, that line just came out like, no, it was never an issue again. Because I had really experienced what she was experiencing by having that conversation with Trigorin. Like, she's like, fucking hell, I cannot believe I'm in this, with this genius writer, this man who's like a god, and he's, you know, my life is forever changed. And like, I felt like that on stage, like, my life is forever changed. I cannot believe my luck. I can't believe I'm here. I'm dreaming. And it never was an issue again.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Have you ever experienced stage fright?
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
Tell me that.
When I did Girls and Boys this year, we got to the last week of rehearsal and I couldn't get through more than like half a page without my throat closing up and bursting into tears. And
why do you think that was? Because it was...
Because it was direct to the audience.
To the audience.
Yeah. And a monologue is an incredibly difficult thing to rehearse because the other character is the audience and you just don't have it. And
right.
So you're trying to rehearse a play with no other... It's like rehearsing. It's just you're rehearsing on your own. And it doesn't matter if they bring in, like, I mean, they were great. They brought in, like, they'd bring in, like, 12 people who worked in the theatre to come and watch me rehearse when I did a run-through. But it didn't actually help because the contract was wrong. Like, I was meant to be in a costume, under lights, on a raised stage. Like, there was, with a monologue, I think it has to be a storytelling mode and you need to have some authority in a way of just being the one that they're listening to, and that doesn't work when you're on the same level in a lit dressing room where there's no magic there, there's no artifice. So on the Friday before the first preview, I hadn't got through a run through yet. I couldn't get it out. I was just, my throat was closing up. I was running off to the balcony outside and we were having all these crisis chats and, you know, I was genuinely like, what's the worst thing that could happen if I just bailed on this? Like,
oh, really?
That point? And actually, Vicky Featherston, I think what was so great was Vicky, who's the artistic director, and Lindsay, who is my director, said, like, we can just cancel it. Like, it's a play, you know. And if it's going to be a really hard thing, if it's going to hurt you, like, just don't do it. We can cancel it. And they were so, they meant it. It was the most amazing.
You don't think that was reverse psychology?
I don't think it was. I mean, obviously, like, it worked, but I don't think it was. I think they meant it. That's the kind of people they are, though. They're very, like, it's
just... So you were in a full panic.
Oh, big time.
And how did you sort of like, how did you sleep with that?
I just had to live with the possibility for a couple of days that it might just not work, that it could
like
just
dread.
Be
dread?
Kind of. But then at the same time, I said to them, like, they were like, look, we can cancel. I was like, we don't need to. I know that as soon as I've got a costume on and I'm on the stage and the lights are up, I'll be able to do it. I just can't do it in the rehearsal room. And I'm not being a dick. I'm not being like, I just can't get it out. But I know that once I'm in costume, I'll do it. And I didn't know the words by Sunday night still. I didn't know the whole script. And my mum like sent me off. She was like, you and Marcus, my husband, off to go to a hotel and just spend, and she took the kids and she was like, and just spend the whole day and just learn it. And just finish learning it. Because I still didn't have the whole thing.
Was Marcus like, I don't want to have to learn it.
Marcus was great because he's endlessly patient. But it was just like repetition over and over and over again. It still hadn't gone in my, it was 16,000 words. Like it just hadn't gone in my, I'd only had 4 weeks to learn it.
Maybe that's why your throat was closing.
So it was like all panic stations. Everyone was kind of freaking out, but pretending that everything was fine. Like everyone was trying to like manage it, but no one wanted to make a big deal. But I think probably everyone was secretly going like, fuck, she's not gonna, like this run. People are paying
that cliche
tickets.
Of like, oh, I'm the star and she doesn't have her lines.
No one
can tell her.
Yeah. So it was, you know, mum was like, go and learn them. So went off, learnt the lines, and then we went in and I did a dress rehearsal. And I got halfway through and I called it because I was feeling really ill. And the second half of the play starts to go into the really difficult stuff. And I was like, I don't need to go. But we'd done half. So I was like, so I know I can do half. So now I just need to be able to do the whole thing. But then I couldn't understand why I'd felt so uncomfortable. And I'd felt fine enough to do it. Like I got it out, but there was something that wasn't right. And then I said to Lindsay, can I just take my shoes off for the next one? Can I just not wear shoes? Because I just can't do it wearing shoes. And now I tell the story and I sound like such a weirdo.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Such a diva, but it's not. It was just like there was a kind of dance quality to it where you needed to be like light on your feet to be able to like move, and particularly with the children. Like, and there was something about like clumping around on the stage on shoes that didn't feel like. It worked. Anyway, so the next night we did another dress rehearsal. I took my shoes off. I went on stage. I did it barefoot and it was fine. And then we went
into the crew was like, oh my God, she took her shoes off.
I know, but I was in London, so they were fine. In New York, that would have been an actual like health and safety thing.
Right, I'm sure it would have come.
But in London, they were like, cool. But yeah, it was, and then it was never a problem again. So that was the most stage fright I've ever had.
Wow.
God. Yeah, it was awful.
Well, you say that, and I wonder about I wonder what it felt like full house right before you walk out on stage. Like, do you remember wondering, like, is this going to work?
I was fucking terrified. But I was like, above everything else, above any of the shit that you're doing, you're a mum and you have two kids. So, my God, this is so weird. So I held my daughter's hand and I held my baby and then stood backstage like that for like 10 seconds and then I walked on and did it. But I was like, if this all goes fucking wrong, who gives a shit? I have got two beautiful children. Like, so, like, I get a bad review or, like, I have to walk off. Fuck it. They're never going to give a shit. Like, they don't care. So I'll just, I, like, held my daughter's hand, held my son, like, thought about them, and then the lights went out and I walked on stage and then we did the show.
God, you know, you say that and I realize everybody that's in these high-pressure situations where it feels like everything's riding on it, everyone has to find their own way to somehow putting their themselves in order, their priorities are...
Well, exactly. And I do, you know, because I lean towards being anxious and you know, and insecure about stuff, I have to constantly remind myself that it's you know, I love my job. I'm so proud of the job that I do, but I'm not performing brain surgery. I'm dressing up and pretending. And like the whole reason I wanted to do this forever was that it was the most fun thing, like the most fun job. And, you know, you get to create a piece of art with a bunch of fun people. Like that was the point.
Yeah, don't spoil it for yourself.
Don't ruin it by thinking like it's a play, you know. It's a play, it's a movie, like don't, you know, people have there's so much more in the world where people really are living at the highest stakes, and the jobs that they do really are life and death. Like, nothing I ever do will be that. That's such a privilege, and I'm so lucky to just be able to, like, be a storyteller. And that's how I talk about it with my daughter. She wants to know what I'm doing, and I tell her I tell stories. And, like, isn't that the best job ever, just to be a storyteller? So when I get in my own way, I have to remind myself, like, you just tell stories. Like, that's all it is.
Well, I think it's a hard thing, because I think to be able to get to the level where you are, you have to take it so seriously. Mm. That you have to almost trick your body into it being life and death. And like, to claim ownership as an artist, I think that takes, like, that's not something you can necessarily do if you're just a mom. Like, you have to go through that period where it is life and death for you, I would assume, to get there.
Yeah, and I mean, that's probably why I'm so, you know, I've always felt so connected to the Seagull, because, you know, I really felt like that. I really fully felt like Nina when I was younger. Like, I was desperate to be an actress. Like, I used to cry about the prospect of it not working out. Like, I was fully, it was all I wanted from the world. So I have lived through the, like, nothing matters more than this happening. But now I don't feel that way. Now there are many, many things that matter more.
You've grown up.
Yes, thank God.
What I hear you talking about, though, when you're talking about not being able to finish the rehearsal because the audience isn't there, or you're going to figure out the character when you're on set, like, you sort of need that reality.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not my best judge, I think. I think sometimes I do a performance and I think it went really well and it doesn't mean anything to them, you know. Like, particularly on stage, I've had shows where I felt like, oh yeah, that was really great. And then the director will come back and be like, we couldn't really get to you. Like, maybe
so
I was living
a bit
more
that?
For myself. Get bummed out for
you
a minute.
You have to ignore either yourself or the director. Like, you have to sort of, like, decide, right?
Yeah, well, I suppose, like, particularly with girls and boys, like, I didn't have to live that fully out every night because it was such dark material that, and it's not, and I've never found it possible to do that 8 shows a week. Not by any choice, but just that, like, you tend to have a really good show that's really truthful and you totally believe in it, and the next night it just isn't there for some reason, and you kind of have to act it more than I would like to. But the thing that sort of gives me relief from that is that that's generally not their experience of it. Like, their experience will be different, and sometimes they will be less connected to the shows where you're really, really feeling it.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's more interesting to watch someone try not to cry than it is to watch someone bawling their eyes out. It's more moving to watch someone try and hold back their emotion than it is to just watch them let it all go. So sometimes it can, you know, I'm probably indulgent and I think that it's much more powerful than it is. But it's kind of a relief to think, like, gosh, they will, you know, their experience of this show is going to be totally different from mine. And you can't do much about that except just try and be honest and find new ways of telling the same story. But, all of that is to say that I probably don't, you know, I've probably got a sort of skewed idea of what good is, because it's probably good to me is not as interesting as, like, some other version of it.
One of the things that I read that you said about this play was that you've spent your whole career trying to forget that people are watching you.
Mm.
And obviously, this is the play where you can't forget that. But it made me think of the movie Shame, and specifically the scene in the nightclub where you sing New York, New York.
Mm.
And I was just curious about, in a situation like that, how you step up and do something that vulnerable and forget that you're being watched when there's a camera. I mean, that looked like a fairly normal lens. I'm assuming the camera's right here. And if you look back at your career, one of the more challenging days, or one of those things where you have to get over yourself and not have that judge or that self-critic.
That whole film was, really. I mean, I think one of the first things we shot was the scene where Michael's in his bedroom and he's overhearing Sissy on the phone, and I'm sitting on the window ledge trying, like, begging my horrible abusive boyfriend to take me back. And Steve just asked me to improvise, so I was just improvising this awful conversation. And it started in the most awkward way, where I started, and then we ran for, like, a couple of minutes, and then it was sort of turned out all right. But even that was, like, that to be the first thing that I did in that job was like, oh, this is what this film's going to be like. It's going to be terrifying.
So almost by the like time a challenge.
So by the time I got to shooting that scene in the Boom Boom Room, I was like, I kind of was in that space where that every day with Steve was like, okay, here we are. Like, this is what this kind of film is. It's just, you know, and I'd done the scene where you meet my character, where I'm like completely naked. And, you know, all of this every day was like pretty full on. So by the time we got to that, you know, and I'd had a lot of rehearsal with that, with the singing coach, and I had a whiskey. It's the only time I've ever had alcohol on set, but it's super helped. And then I did it, and it was actually fine. We did like 3 full takes. It was all one take. And then we had a break, and he came up to me, and he was like, so she can't have just sung one song, right? And I was like, no, I don't think so. No, she must have done like a set. And he was like, okay, so we need a set. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said,
really?
Well, yeah, we need like the last 2 lines of a song. That will be the last 2 lines of the song, and then like people will clap, and then you go and sit down, and then the scene starts with you guys. And I was like, okay, well, what do you want me to sing? He was like, oh, I don't know. Just make something up. I was like, well, what should we make something up? He said, well, we can't have a song that anyone knows because we can't get the rights for it, and we can't check the rights. So just like make up a song, and just, you know, just do that, and then go and sit down. I said, Steve, I don't know. I don't know how to make it. He was like, you're an artist, aren't you? And I was like, yeah. So he said, well, so just make up a song. And then he just walked off, and I was like, all right. So then I had to get up, and like I sang the last 2 lines of this song about,
so you,
like,
you went and wrote a song.
I wrote like 2 lines, and like, you know, it was like something about a rose, and then, you know, and then after, in post, they added a piano on top of it, and then, yeah,
I could see that going very badly, where you, if you're somebody else, you'll call your agent and like, this director's asking me to write a song.
Steve McQueen's also like a friggin' genius. So I don't think I think everyone would be, you know, you just want to do the right thing. But it doesn't come from, he's not remotely combative. It's not like, he's like a cheerleader. He's like, yeah, you're a fucking artist. Go and write a song. You're like,
did you not think to say, you're an artist, you write a song?
No, he was already doing all his artistry. But I kind of, you know, I was completely for a moment like, well, fuck. And then I just thought, what are you going to do? You're going to like whinge about this, or you're not going to like come up with a song? So I went and made up a song. But I loved that. Like, I'd make 15 films with Steve where it was all like that, because it's the most live theatre. You know, it just feels completely visceral and real, and nothing is acting, and everything is just real life, and that's my favorite way to work.
It makes me wonder about how many missed opportunities there are in general for your caliber of artist, where you're excited to be challenged, and you're excited to be pushed out of your comfort zone, and it's just sort of not done, or that there's a certain amount of respect that kind of keeps anyone from asking you to, you know what I mean? I guess I just wonder if those are things that you go towards or that you avoid.
Totally. I mean, that's the whole reason I, Girls and Boys, the biggest draw to doing that was that it was a comedy. Like, it starts as a comedy. It's funny. And it's just anecdotal storytelling. It's funny. There's nothing. And I'd never done that before. And it scared the shit out of me, like, trying to be funny in a Cockney accent, no less. And just talking directly to an audience. And I'd spent my entire career, like, being like, you know, not there, forget they're not there, forget the focus puller isn't there, forget the camera isn't there, like, just focus on the other actor, tell the truth, look in their eyes. And then was like, I'm going to do a monologue where I'm just going to look at the people, and I had no idea how scary that was till I was actually doing it. But the reason I did it was because it scared the crap out of me. And, you know, and I think there is something addictive about that. Like, that's what I got from Steve, was like, terrifying, going toe-to-toe with Michael Fassbender. Like, he's an extraordinary actor. And Steve challenged us constantly. But, like, that's kind of an addictive thing, like, wanting to be... And I think people are really risk-averse, and they are in our industry, and everyone wants to play it safe. Everyone wants to follow the algorithm that gets the most bums on seats and gets the most money in the box office or gets the most awards. But there's totally not... That's just not where great storytelling lies. So it's people who are really bold, like Paul, who wants to tell a story about a quote-unquote unlikable woman, or you know, where that's where the, it sort of lives, is those kind of interesting. But that's what I get. So that's the stuff I kind of try and seek out, is like, what's going to be, what's going to give that feeling of like, make up a song, you know?
Yeah. And then the heart starts going.
Yeah.
And then when you come out through the other side, it's like you have superpowers.
Yes. Well, exactly. And that's what Girls and Boys felt like, is like, it felt like a tightrope walk. And I would come off stage being like, I didn't fall off. I just did a tightrope walk between the Twin Towers and I didn't fall off because I managed to keep an audience engaged for 90 minutes. Like, but it does, you just do feel like you've performed a magic trick and you can't quite believe you got away with it. And that's massively, like, that's such a great feeling.
Do you like those situations in real life? Like, is it easier to sing in character in Shame than it is maybe to sing at a dinner party?
Oh my God. I had to sing for Inside Llewyn Davis. They had a concert for the film, and they had like Patti Smith and like everyone who was involved in the film already, and all these extraordinary artists, and they asked everyone to sing, and I had to sing because I was in the film, and I fucking have never been more scared in my life. It was terrifying. And I honestly can't say that I massively enjoyed it. I'm like, I've never been more privileged to be in a film. Like, I cannot still to this day believe that I was in a Coen Brothers film. They're my favorite filmmakers in the universe. But being in that concert was like genuinely painful.
I have to do that to be in the film?
I was the only person in the film who wasn't a real life singer. So all these people are like totally at home on stage. Like, that's their thing. Like, and I was the only one who had never, ever stood up. And, you know, not since I was a kid at, like, the town hall drama class on a weekend had I stood up and sang a song in front of people.
Would that qualify as
myself?
Your scariest moment?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It was terrifying. Way, way scarier than anything I've done in acting.
Do you and Marcus sing at home?
No.
You don't?
No.
I think you should have a family band.
No, I'm not allowed. No, I'm, by my kids, I mean. It's not a massive, I mean, I can hold a tune, but like, it's never been a thing for me.
I think you're a good singer.
Oh, thanks.
I don't think you could have done that New York, New York thing if you weren't a good singer. That's a hard song to sing. I think family band. Your kids will grow out of that phase where they don't want you to sing.
And yeah, and what, and then they'll get.
You can get in the bath together and.
Yeah, and we'll just have a good old sing song.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's something kind of excruciating about it.
There is something funny about this idea that you can be such an amazing vessel of expressing vulnerability and revealing humanity in a way that transfers to an audience, and yet sort of in your own life and the world, that's not necessarily something that you revel in.
I mean, I think life is, thank God, you know, relatively undramatic. It has been for me. I've been so lucky, and I certainly don't have any childhood trauma to draw on. Like, you know, but I can also recognize that the majority of roles I've done have been like quite seriously dramatic. But it's also something that sort of reminds you. I mean, like, there's, you know, doing Suffragette. I was so happy doing that job, being surrounded by these women, but also like it was kind of a constant reminder. And I this was really genuinely part of the shooting of it, was like, these women were unbelievable, like, that they did this and that this happened and that women starved themselves and died and, you know, fought, and in a time when it was completely outrageous to do. And like, so sometimes it is also a case of like the work just highlighting how profoundly blessed you are, and, you know, God willing, I'll never have to endure that kind of pain. And it gave me the most unbelievable, you know, respect for women who endure the absolute worst and come through and do extraordinary things with their lives. So I think, you know, that's such a great sort of bonus of this job, is like you get to step into other people's lives and experiences and then, you know, appreciate things in a different way, or appreciate people in a different way.
Yeah. What I hear you saying is that you have an opportunity to not only live these other lives, but to bring them to other people.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, the fact that the story of Emily Wilding Davison hadn't been told, like the suffragette story of these women going on hunger strike and a woman throwing herself underneath the king's horse at a national event. It was the first piece of news footage that went around the world.
It's the first viral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've never made a film about it, because film has been made by men, about men. You know, but this was like a basic civil rights, enormous civil rights movement, and no one's ever touched it because films have been driven by men for so long. But we now know that's not the case, and that, you know, films driven by women. Women go to the cinema, they pay to see films, and they are, you know, it's been disproved a million times, but it's just taken us this long to figure it out.
You know, I look at your body of work, and I do see that you are choosing stories that are, they do have that value. Mm. And I think that's one way to make it important, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes my agent, who's been my agent since I was 18.
Judy Dench's agent.
She said to me about a job once that we sort of ummed and ahed over and then decided not to do. And she said, well, darling, you won't be telling your grandchildren about this one. So it's probably not the right thing to do. And so that is a sort of funny way of it. But I do think that I do want to be able to, there has to be some quality to it where it is something that I will, you know, always feel connected to, always feel proud of, always feel, you know, it feels more vocational than just doing things for the sake of doing them. Like, there has to be something that I'll always remember about that, or always feel pleased that I got involved in some way.
Well, I like you very much, and I think you're earnest, and I think you're thoughtful, and your husband's lucky that you deemed him worthy to be married to. And I've enjoyed talking to you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey folks, that's our show. And I have to say, I feel so lucky that I get to have conversations with these artists and dive deep into their process and find out that they have the same insecurities and same struggles that we all have. And talking to Carrie was incredible because she seems like somebody that had it all together out of the gate. And then we find out that she had a totally different story going on in her head. And I guess that is sort of the mystery of art. Definitely, if you haven't yet, go see Wildlife. She gives an amazingly real and disturbing performance. And then after that, just type Carrie Mulligan into whatever service you use to watch films and watch everything she's ever done, because she's incredible. And I was so happy to have her on. Now, as you know, we've had a lot of people on this show, over 170 and counting. And if you missed any or all of them, or if you've never seen our television show, I suggest you go to Off Camera right now and take a deep dive into the off-camera television experience. Now, we're on the Audience Network on DirecTV, and that's a great way to see us. There's also some episodes on Netflix, but if you want to see all the episodes on any device as many times as you want, the best way to do it is to go to offcamera.com and get our television subscription. It's only $4.99 a month, and you can have access to our entire archive. So that's a great way to experience the visual side of Off Camera. Also, if you're enjoying this podcast and you haven't yet subscribed yet, take a minute, subscribe to the show so you won't miss an episode. And then while you're there, give us a rating, leave us a review. Every time you do that, it helps more people find the show, which helps us to keep doing the show. So if you're loving what we're doing, take a minute and help us out with that. Also, if you're on social media, and let's face it, who's not these days, go to Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram and share us with the world. Facebook is a great place to suggest guests to us or just to tell your friends how much you love the show. Also, you can find me on social media. I'm Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. You can pick up on behind-the-scenes stuff for the show, see exclusive photographs, and stay in tune with what we're doing. So check all that out. And I want to thank everyone that helps us on this show, because we couldn't do a show without the talented and hardworking people that make all this a reality. We have Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, and Matt Davidson, who we all know the whole thing would fall apart if he wasn't here 15 hours a day slaving away. So thanks to everybody that works on the show. And be sure to join us next time when I sit down with actor Ted Danson, who I grew up watching on TV. And little did I know, he was at the same time busy doing some growing up himself.
I learned on Cheers to keep my mouth shut and just let the fact that beautiful women were being hired to be on the set saying, oh my God, Sam Malone is so sexy. I'm dying on the inside and terrified and unbelievable as a man about town. I didn't have that arrogance. I never went to bars. I never picked up somebody. You know, if the woman was standing opposite me, buck naked, I'd go, oh, oh me? Oh, good. How wonderful.
Like everyone else, I tuned into Cheers every week, and I assumed that Ted was Sam Malone, which is the ultimate compliment to an actor, but also could be quite confusing when the character you play is actually nothing like who you are in real life. And although the fame and recognition was nice, and being hailed and revered by the denizens of frat brothers at every watering hole in the world was flattering, there was a disconnect. And after some very public failings, Ted met the love of his life, and in the process, changed his life. We talk about the very fortuitous experience of Ted getting to play himself on Curb Your Enthusiasm. We talk about why dyeing your hair is just a way to avoid the conversation about actually dying. And I find out how a simple, hey, can speak volumes. See you next time, off camera.